The Transmitter.
Welcome to our podcast here at The Transmitter. This show is called Synaptic, and it looks at the people, the research, and the challenges of the neuroscience space. Thank you for joining us. This is episode 17 of Synaptic. My name is Brady Huggett, and I host the show. All right, now, for today, I'd like us to go to Chicago, the third largest city in America by population. And I'd like to go back to the year 2000. That year, in Chicago, the city was home to 519,810 people aged 20 to 29 years. So that is more than 500,000 young adults. The city had a bustling food scene even then. That year, the dining establishments in the Chicago area pulled in about $10 billion in sales, which put it second among metropolitan areas in the U.S. behind Los Angeles. And while Chicago's theater community has grown since then, even in 2000, it already boasted the Goodman Theater, the Chicago Theater, the Court Theater, and the Steppenwolf Theater Company. And of course, given its location along Lake Michigan, Chicago offers 26 miles of free beaches. Now, right around this time, 2000, a recent college graduate in China named Lin Tian was looking to go abroad and attend graduate school. That's our guest for today, Lin Tian. She had a serious boyfriend at the time. Later, they would get married, and they wanted to study in the U.S. together. So they sent out about 20 applications and decided they would go to whatever school accepted them both. Now, that turned out to be Baylor University and Northwestern University. They chose Northwestern. It's a big city, as Lin says in this podcast. And for young people like her and her boyfriend, the bustle that Chicago provided seemed attractive. Now, once at Northwestern, Lin came across the lab of Andreas Matuszczyk, and she thought it was a good fit for her interests. Biochemistry is the foundation for everything, she said, and she already found protein structure and function fascinating. When she began to work with him, Matuszczyk pushed her to be collaborative, to approach other labs at Northwestern when she had questions that she could not answer herself. And he challenged her to think about the ways that she could expand her skill set, as she said. And she would take that message forward into her career. We talked about that on this podcast. We also talked about how, for the first week of her postdoc, she felt so out of place that she considered quitting. And we talked about how her father's innate curiosity rubbed off on her as a girl. And we talked about the future of exploring the brain and how she wants her lab to do work that is high risk, high reward. All of that coming up in the next hour or so. I interviewed Lin on August 14th, 2024, in her office in the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience in Jupiter, Florida. It was a hot Florida day, temperature in the low 90s, bright sun, and the beach not far away. I put the mics across her desk and we began. So let's pick it up here where Lin is telling me about her move to Jupiter and what she likes about her new town. That should be enough to get us started. So here's your episode of Synaptic with Lin Tian, starting right now.
I have a Wikipedia page or something.
But so, no, yeah, I also have never been to Jupiter before. What do you think of it?
Actually, I really like this place, yeah. So it's kind of people, you know, here, they come everywhere. They're not like, haven't met people who actually, you know, grew up here.
Everyone's like a transplant.
As a transplant, I feel like I live in a northeast neighborhood. All my neighbors, they moved at some point from, you know, northeast.
Oh,
yeah, like
really?
A lot of New Yorkers, actually.
You know, that's what my Uber driver was saying, that everybody here is from New York.
They moved down,
beach houses, exactly. Et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, my whole neighborhood, you know, nobody actually grew up here, which is amazing. Yeah.
So that's like, you're a transplant, they're a transplant, everyone's a transplant here.
Everyone's a transplant, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and people are very friendly here, yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, they kind of nice and kind.
I'll take it.
You'll take it. Yeah. So it's a nice beach town. I feel like it's it's much better than what I expected. And after living here for almost a year, I really like it. Hmm. You know, it's, I live here too. I'm 5 minutes from work. You know, my kids go to school, and there are a lot of kids in the neighborhood. And you know, this is the whole campus has Max Planck,
yeah,
Scripps, and FAU. It's a very dynamic campus. Yeah.
Yeah. When I mean, I guess we'll get to this eventually. But when you first thought of coming to Jupiter, what did you think? Had you been to Florida before?
No, it's never actually on my roadmap. I never have thought about moving to Florida because I always just thinking I'm just gonna retire at UC Davis.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very nice community. I just never thought about this. Actually, my family, this never be on a roadmap.
It's funny because people retire here all the time.
I know, exactly. So everyone just tell me, like, you just, you know, you move the place, you know, maybe 20 years earlier.
Yeah, that's right. You just start early.
Start early.
But so you, I mean, obviously you're not Floridian by birth. No.
No.
Where were you born?
No. I was born in China.
What part?
In the middle of China. It's a historical city called Xi'an.
Oh, Xi'an.
Yeah. So I grew up there. Yeah.
What historical in what way? Like temples, pagodas?
Yeah, everything. Yeah, I think it's the capital of the 12th dynasty in China.
Oh,
so
I see.
It's a very historical city. And everyone, you know, like all the foreigners, they have to visit that place. Even for people growing up outside China, they go back to China, they visit the place, and they feel like, oh, they found their roots there. And that's mean like really historic place.
Oh, yeah. So people from China come to your town?
Yeah.
Because that's like the one of the original cities of the Chinese dynasty.
Yeah, and even people who grew up outside China, right?
Yeah.
Like, for example, American-born Chinese, they go back to China, they visit, they still have to go back to my town because they think that they go there, they see the history, they can see their roots. Yeah, they feel like, oh, that's where actually I
came from. Yeah. What was it like to grow up in this historical city? I mean, could you feel, you're walking around as a child, can you feel the history, or is it just you didn't think about it?
Yeah, the history is everywhere. It's kind of like Rome. I don't know if you have been Rome before.
I have, so
it feels like exactly as Rome. Everywhere you go, you turn around, it's a historic site. But when you grow up there, you don't feel it, right? It's just normal.
Yeah.
But then when I left, I feel like, oh my gosh, I actually grew up in such a historic place. Yeah, I guess I haven't really get chance to really study Chinese history, but because I grew up here, yeah.
When you go someplace new, you realize what the old place had. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. How is it that your family was there?
Oh yeah, so I'm the only child in my family. My dad is engineer, and my mom is HR manager.
Uh huh.
Yeah. So I just grew up in a very normal family. I'm actually the first scientist in my family. Yeah.
Well, what kind of engineer was your father?
My father is a civil engineer.
Oh, civil.
Yeah, civil. Yeah.
Okay. So when you're growing up, you don't have a model for science.
No, I don't have a model for science. Yeah, I'm the first scientist in my whole family, both on my mom's side and my father's side. Yeah.
How did you find your interest?
I guess it just, the life takes the course, right? The life takes you where you go, and also opportunities. When I was young, my mom told me, like, I still have a picture, actually. My mom framed it after I became a scientist. I was really into figure out how things works.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you know, I was once like really fascinated about the fruit fly sample, and then just to look at the wing patterns on the microscope. Well, I was like a kindergartner. Yeah.
Wait a minute. You were looking at fruit flies in kindergarten?
Yeah.
Your school was doing that?
My school was doing that.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So, and then after that, I've been doing a lot of like small experiments. I'm fascinated about how the caterpillar transformed to a butterfly.
Yeah,
so I did some experiment in my own my in-house and grow the caterpillar, and to just watch the whole course of how the life transforms.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I guess I'm just very curious. That's my nature.
Hmm.
I'm always curious to find how things works. And then after I grew up, I went to very science and technology focused university. It's called University of Science
and Technology.
Yeah, for China. It's just interesting that most majority of the students there, they actually, you know, they after they graduate, they come to U.S. You know, for graduate study. So I guess from long time ago, I have also my dad, because his work, he always travel abroad, and he will bring me like a lot of new things. You know, back when I grew up, China is not like today, right? It's still very closed environment.
So this was, when did you grow up? What decade?
I'm 45 years old.
So it would have been
I grew up that how many decades? Yeah.
The 80s?
The 80s. Yeah,
so
the 80s.
So right, so China was just beginning to open up in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. China just being opened up, and you feel like this inspiration to go abroad to explore. And I also have this curiosity kind of nature. Uh-huh. I just always want to see, what's outside my world. And my father at time, you know, he also travels abroad a lot. So he always bring me some like a souvenir from Paris, or like from, he traveled to Europe a lot.
Uh-huh.
So he bring me a souvenir, and I'm always thinking, you know, what's my outside world looks like? So I guess that time, now I think back, there are actually a seeds planted in my heart. I really want to go to explore the world, you know. No,
beyond. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So was your father, so two things, I guess. Number one, you could say maybe that a civil engineer also likes to figure things out.
I guess so.
So maybe you might have got some of this from your father.
I guess.
And so if he's traveling around, is he also curious like that?
He's a very curious person, and he always tell me about, like, he actually really, you know, his philosophy always, I feel like, really guided me for my whole life. He teaches me how to do multitasking, you know, when I growing up.
Uh-huh.
Like, he always said, you need to hang on for things, right? You don't give up, never give up. And then just hang on there, and you will eventually overcome the, you know, the challenges. And he always teaching me how to do multitasking, like during the cooking. And he will tell me like, you know, let's cook dinner together, but this you should do first because it takes time. Right, so it's kind of like a biological experiment. When you plan experiment, you need to think about, you know, what's my goal for this week, right? And what I need to prioritize. And while doing this, maybe the time I saved, while I'm waiting, I can do something else. So he taught me how to do that, you know, during making dinners, how to multitasking. So I feel like that's, you know, because my work, I have to really multitasking to kind of integrate my life to science, right, to my work, so juggling between family and my job. So I feel like I just learned how to multitasking when I was young.
So saying don't give up, you
don't
know, persevere, that's perfect for a life in science, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Was that because of his job that he was like that, or he was just like that?
He just liked that. Yeah, he just liked that. He taught me when I was young and during my grew up how to multitasking, how to prioritize things, and also be open-minded. And he always showed me, you know, bring me the souvenir and tell me, you know, you should see the whole world. And he always wanted me to think about beyond where I live, right? Or think about bigger pictures.
So when he brings a souvenir, do you mean like here's he goes to Paris and it's the Eiffel Tower?
Yeah,
or is
Eiffel
it something
Tower.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, he brought me Eiffel Tower. I still have that Eiffel Tower on my desk, and he passed away a few years ago.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, and then 2 years ago we went back to Paris as a whole family, you know, he was not there. And I bought another souvenir, the Eiffel Tower.
Is it here?
No, it's not here. It's at home.
At home.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's a really basic Eiffel Tower you will see everywhere.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, I don't know, like how you, this actually make me thinking about mentoring, right?
Yeah.
Like how do you enable others, how you inspire others, how you teach them, you know, those small things, like building the character, set up for success.
Yeah,
it's very important.
Yeah, so there's either a base level of talent, and you just nurture that by giving them advice on how to do things.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry your father died. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he passed away.
A couple of years ago. Was he in the States?
Yeah, he was. He's in the States. Yeah. So both of my parents, you know, immigrated.
Oh, they did.
About 10 years ago. Yeah.
So that would have been California.
They've been California, yeah.
When you moved here, did they move here?
My mom still thinking about it.
I'm really hoping she's in California.
Yeah, she can move here.
Yeah. I mean, again, you're like, this is a great place to retire. There's all the
retirees. I know. But California has its own charm, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, it definitely does. Yeah. Okay, so you're going to the University of Science and Technology, mm-hmm. right? So that's, I do know where that is, I think. It's like Anhui Province, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
yes,
that's more eastern in China?
It's very eastern China.
Yeah, what
it's
was that
It's about
like?
five hours drive from Shanghai.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah.
So, but you knew at that point that you wanted to do science? Or just, I mean, because, you know, we were talking about the caterpillar, that's more like biology.
Yeah, I'm about neuroscience major.
Yeah. You knew that going in.
I guess, you know, now I think back, I'm not sure. I was really not sure at the time, but I knew there's something I probably want to do. I will be good at it, right? Because I'm always a good kid at school. So usually STEM in China, they put a lot of emphasis on STEM. So all the top students go to STEM. So it's kind of a natural way going to this great school to study science and technology, so and especially biology.
Did you have to take the Gaokao? You did, obviously.
No, I was just recommended by the school. I didn't take it.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I was just, I don't have to do that.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, yeah. I hear how stressful that is.
It was very stressful. I still think it's stressful today.
Yeah.
But I'm just lucky. I guess because my merit, you know, at a school, so they just recommended me for direct, you know, recruit to that university.
Right, so you must have done well in the sciences in your high school.
Yeah, sort of. I did some science competitions.
So when you get in there, you're thinking maybe biology, maybe neuroscience?
Yeah, it's biology. Because I don't know what, you know, in the 90s, right? In 90s, people always think in China, they think, I was always told the 21st century is biology. Yep. It's about technology, right? Like, but at that time, I have no idea what that means. Yeah, like how the technology will really change humanity. I have no idea. But I took it because everyone telling me, and my dad telling me, you know, you should study biology because that's the new era of science. And then getting to the university, the first 2 years we actually study very broadly, not just biology.
Yep.
We have to really study like mathematics, physics, chemistry, and biology. So those four different areas. I think it's really important because first 2 years, because of those foundation, it's equipped me with a skill set to migrate, you know, through different disciplines.
Yeah.
So you just learn, you know how to study. And when you have a question you're trying to answer, you think about not just from one perspective, but from many different perspectives. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very useful. Yeah, and I can see how that pertains to your career today, for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think because that's early days, I studied everything. I don't remember anything.
Yeah,
I feel like I give back to all my teachers. But I think the ways of learning really help you to think about tackle scientific questions today.
Yeah. Because this was a science university, you did not need to take social sciences, literature, you didn't take things.
No,
it was all science.
No, I didn't
science.
Take any of
wow.
that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's so, very heavy STEM.
Yeah. You finished that degree, and then, and as you said, your father had often talked about, you know, maybe going abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Had you planned to go abroad for your PhD? You did.
Right, I did. Yeah, I started when I was in second year in university. I started taking, like, study English, right? Because I have to take GRE. I have to take a TOEFL test.
Yeah.
So I really study hard, you know, English, and to be able to pass those tests. And not just pass, you have to get a really high score.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have to be really good at GPA because it's very selective and competitive as a foreigner.
Yeah, for sure.
During the process. So I start to prepare everything when I'm second year in university.
But you had not studied English yet?
We studied English, but it's not for test-driven.
I see.
It's not like for GRE and those kind of test-driven.
Yeah. So you'd taken English growing up, yeah, but this was specifically for these tests.
For tests, yeah.
Because you did come to the U.S. to study.
Yeah, I did come to the U.S. Back then, there's no internet. I think the internet just started to, like, you know, .com, yeah. right? www.com. The Silicon Valley just started to, you know, take off. For us to apply, we have to go to the library and get the admission office's you know, application form, get their address and phone number. And we do have emails back then.
Yeah.
And then you have to really type out all your application and put in the mail and send to US, and you have no clue what's going to happen. Right? But now I think about it, it's actually amazing. Like, you have this hope, right? You have this hope. You think best thing going to happen to you. It's amazing.
How many schools did you look at?
I think I applied probably 20 schools.
Oh, that many.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's what you mean. You have hope. There's like 20 pieces
of
hope out
20,
there.
Yeah, 20. One of them will work out.
Yeah. Well, so you end up going, I know this, you end up going to Northwestern.
Yeah.
And were you specific, and you worked under Andreas Matuszczyk, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
Were you specifically looking to work with him?
Northwestern is the only university actually take both me and my husband.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we missed a step. So you were both?
So I met him in college. Uh-huh. You know, we're both student in at East, you know, the same university,
yeah.
And also the... No, he's a chemical engineering major.
Uh-huh.
So Northwestern, we applied many schools, and we decided we're going to pick the school. We will both go together.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Northwestern is one of that school.
Okay.
The other one's a Baylor College.
Oh, those are the two.
Yeah, those are two.
Yeah, Baylor's good. Baylor's a
good
great
too.
School. Yeah,
yeah, but then Northwestern, it's in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's a big city. You know, for young people, it's more attractive, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Were you already married?
No,
you were just
married.
You were a couple.
Yeah, we're a couple. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the two of you came to Northwestern.
We came together. Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me. So, all right. So that was the school, and then when you get there, did you find Andreas?
We have to do rotations. So I did 3 rotations, mm-hmm. and then I just found, you know, Andreas Matuszczyk's lab is a good fit for me. You know, studying biochemistry, I feel like biochemistry is a foundation for everything.
Yeah.
That time, and studying protein structure and function, again, you know, think about, you know, how you change some amino acid, and then you can change the function of the protein, and we're trying to study how the, you know, protein aggregation or the protein degradation can lead to activation of a new signaling pathway. I found that's really fascinating. Mm. And plus, he's a really great mentor.
Is he?
Yeah, he's a really great mentor. He always give a lot of positive reinforcement, and he always encourage you and ask you to challenge to think about beyond your skill set, right? Like, think about bigger pictures. Mm.
Meaning what? So let's say you're doing an experiment. Mm-hmm. He would come up and say, I don't know, you know, I can see you're working from it from this angle. Have you considered other angles?
Yeah. And also, I think it's really important at time, you know, his lab is very biochemistry, you know, focused, which means everything happening in a test tube.
Uh-huh.
Right. You know, that's like classical biochemistry.
Yeah.
But then the question, like, what is happening in cells? You know, things happening in a test tube or in a purified protein in E. coli doesn't mean the same thing will happen in a cell or even in a neuron. Like, when you cross the, you know, the biological samples, things may not work the same.
Mm.
So he said, oh, you know, this is happening in a test tube. Have you thought about, you know, take a step further to look at what's happening in the cell? But his lab is not equipped for that. And then I have to take initiative to... go to other lab.
In Northwestern. Yeah.
And to initiate some collaborations across lab. You know, so if you look at my publication as a graduate student, it's already started a collaboration. So I guess at that time, he already challenged me to think, oh, how can you collaborate to really expand your skill set or asking questions from, you know, beyond what the, you know, you have to go to find the resources.
Yeah, almost like, here's what you know,
mm-hmm.
but there are other people who know other things. Let's ask them.
Let's
right?
ask them.
So then you get this larger body of knowledge to tackle this problem.
Yeah, but you have to, but as a graduate student, you know, back then you can think about, it's actually quite daunting to go to another professor and working in another lab and really learn a brand new skill set. For example, how to grow cells and how to measure protein, you know, with a confocal microscope. Because his lab, you know, you find it very comfortable in your own lab. Yeah. But if you have to learn new things in other lab, it's a challenge, right? But the thing is, what I'm stuck in my project, and he will think, tell me, oh, maybe you can think from different perspective. Then I will think about who actually can help me. Hmm. And I will bring this question to other professors and tell them, okay, this is my challenge. How should I tackle it, right? And then that's how the collaboration start.
Yeah. When you say, you said it's daunting. Is it daunting because, well, you have to be a little vulnerable. You have to go say, I'm stuck. I don't know how to do this. Can you help me? And maybe you don't want to look that way. You'd rather, like, if I could just figure it out on my own. And is that what you mean by it's daunting?
Yes. That's what I tell my students these days as well, right? You can figure things yourself. But sometimes we can really use help, right? So how did you build this collaborative environment? You know, we all work as a group because everyone has your own strengths and weakness. And we need to understand what's our strengths and what our weakness. And we can find help to overcome our weakness, right? But you can use your strengths. So it's the same thing as a student. I was a student, you know, I would go out, I'm stuck. I need some help. Can I do some experiment in your lab, right? It's not easy. It's not easy to do.
Yeah.
But he kind of encouraged me to
do that.
To do that and to initiate some collaborations. So I guess actually I learned how to collaborate when I was a graduate student.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more you did it get easier to go up and say, hey, I have a problem. I want to learn more. Can I come into your lab?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But that time I also realized, you know, lab has a wall, right? We don't want the lab has a wall. We want the lab without borders.
Uh-huh.
So for trainees can freely migrate different lab, right? I think that's really important.
Yeah.
So that's actually prompted me to go to HHMIG Linea.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So we should say your PhD, you're looking at the proteasome for your PhD, right? I think you had a couple papers in there, like Nature Structural and Molecular Biology papers.
You know me well. You did all the research.
So, but you're saying those had a bunch of authors on them because you collaborated across Northwestern, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years for your PhD?
Yeah, 6 years.
6 years.
Yeah.
And I know that you did your postdoc at Genelia.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious because I think Genelia, you know, it started in 2006. So it had to be brand new.
It's brand new. That's why it's so exciting. You know, I started my postdoc in April 2007. Yeah, so I'm one of those first cohort of postdoc at Genelia.
How did you know, without seeing, you know, all the people who'd come through Genelia,
mm-hmm.
or the amount of research or the quality of research that was coming out, because it was brand new, how did you know that that's where you wanted to go?
Because I was just so inspired by their philosophy, right? You know, we'll work together as a team to tackle big questions or challenges. And we'll do that by inventing new technology. So that's kind of what I always wanted, what I was already doing when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to go to a place there's no walls. And I can learn all the new skill set, to be able to gain a new skill set and to be able to tackle bigger picture questions. I want to do. I want to be fearless. So I don't have to worry, oh, I'm going to go to ask that professor, can I work in your lab to learn this? Because I'm stuck. I really need to learn this to do, you know, this, address this question. I feel like if you can go to a place, you only need to focus on asking questions. You don't have to worry about whether you will be able to capable. There are a lot of support infrastructure to lower the barrier of accessing the resource. You know, that's just great because that's really aligned with what I want to do. You know, go after exciting ideas with all means, and I don't have to worry.
Let me see if I'm getting this right. So at Northwestern, you have a problem. You're working on a big question and you're stuck. You have to go around to professors and say, hey, I'd like to learn more about this.
Right.
Can you help me with this? I have a question. And you actually learned to do that, and you liked it. You got mm-hmm. good at doing that. But at Genelia, there's like one question, and everybody already knows they're all working on it. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to go around and ask people. Everybody's already focused on it. Is that what you're saying?
It's not everyone already focused on it. It what I mean is you can just focus on asking big picture questions, but you don't have to worry about, oh, I need this technology, but I don't know it. How do I get access to it, right? So the Genelia already has this philosophy that we need to lower the barrier to access this technology. Mm. They have this supporting infrastructure system to help you. Like, for example, if I want to do the two-photon imaging, uh-huh. I can just go to Kuo-Arso Boda's lab, and I will be able to do it in his lab. I don't have to get permission. I don't have to feel like there's a wall.
Yeah.
There.
Yep.
Yeah. So I only need to focus out. This is what I want to ask. This is a question. This is a challenge. And I do have a roadblock, but I can just, you know, it's yeah. so easy. I feel like that science should be done.
Yeah.
But I know, but at the time, the Genelia just opened up. Nobody know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But they focus on brain research, right? Like yeah. neuroscience and also system neuroscience. Yeah. I have no idea what system neuroscience even means because I'm a cell biologist. Yeah.
So that was a big change for you too.
It's a big, big change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, after first week of postdoc, I was actually thinking quitting postdoc because I feel like, you know, it just, the questions they ask at a very different level, something I never thought about. I'm a cell biologist. I just don't know how to. It's just very overwhelming the first week. But then again, you know, I think at that time I really like the movie. I don't know if you saw the movie called Kung Fu Panda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah. So I love that movie because sometimes I'm that panda, right? You're trying to do system neuroscience, but you're a panda. Uh-huh. You're not. You don't look like a system neuroscientist. Uh-huh. You don't have the training to be the system neuroscientist. But eventually, the panda becomes the king of kung fu. Right? You can learn. You can learn. Be open-minded, and eventually, you'll be able to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's. I always think that time. You know, that movie really helped me, because I just feel like, you know, I'm a cell biologist. I came from Northwestern. I'm doing protein. Ubiquitin protein pathway signal, like very cell boundary molecular driven
yeah, yeah.
question. And all of a sudden I enter this place. They're trying to ask a very big question about how the brain works, right? And all this technology they use at time, like for example, to photon imaging, I was like, it's just so overwhelming. Yeah, I never thought about I would be able to do those things. Mm. Yeah.
So the first week, I mean, longer than a week or the first week, you're like, I'm overwhelmed. I might have made a mistake.
Yeah, the first week. Actually, I have to say the first month.
First month.
Feel like that yeah. way. But then I tell myself I can do it. Right? I would just have to be open-minded and willing to learn new things.
Yeah. So I should ask, so did your, I don't know if you were married or not then, but did your husband come with you to Virginia?
He actually, he works in D.C. By the time. Yeah.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
why I also trying to find a postdoc with geographic limitation.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So the both of you came to D.C., mm-hmm. Virginia area. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you worked under Lauren Luger there,
Lauren
I think.
Lauren Luger.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I think he's also very collaborative.
Oh, he's very collaborative. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your time like working under him?
He's also very supportive.
And he's like, he was doing protein bioengineering at this point, right? So this was a change for you too?
It's not, actually when I first applied, I was thinking, oh, that'd be great. Because I was working on the proteins and the protein structure and function, but I'm working on one protein at a time.
Yeah.
So when I'm looking at his work, I said, oh, I really want to learn computational modeling. Because I want to learn how can you work with a complex system based on simulation and prediction.
Yeah.
You don't look at one protein at a time. You can look at network level. So that's actually the beginning. I was really driven to that idea to be able to build a network model for postsynaptic proteins. Yeah, I was really hoping to learn protein modeling.
Yeah.
You know, and how you can use a computation to design, to change the protein structure to the function.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to understand how they work at network level, they collectively.
And so I think, I can't remember how long you're at Genelia, maybe 4 years?
No, I was there for almost 6 years.
Six, yeah.
Another 6 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess, you know, postdocs have to end, right? So eventually you're like, well, I need to go see if I can get a job as a proper professor.
Yeah. So I just, at the beginning, actually, I was not really determined to become a professor. Mm. I was actually thinking about alternative careers, because I don't know if you remember back in that time, I think there's a depression, you know, in
US,
economic-wise, and a lot of professors struggling getting funded. And actually, I witnessed this during my graduate school. I just feel like maybe that's not the life I want.
Yeah.
It's very stressful. So I was actually thinking, oh, maybe I would do my postdoc, thinking about academia, but at the same time, I'm not really committed. I was thinking, okay, I can maybe do some alternative career, so we have a alternative career committee formed at Genelia.
Oh.
At that time, you know, I'm the committee member, so we kind of arranged some alternative career workshop. But it turned out only a couple postdocs showed up. Right, so I'm like, oh, okay, I guess my fellow postdoc nobody interested in alternative career. They also dedicated in academia, but I guess I don't have the confidence to know, you know, I will be able to do it. So that's why I'm thinking about a different path.
Like what? Like you maybe move to industry,
like industry or
work at the NIH.
Working at NIH, scientific writing, there are a bunch of those, you know, alternate careers. They're also really good, important career. But I guess, then I was thinking, oh, maybe my fellow students, my fellow postdocs are not interested. I think that they're just so confident this will work out. But at that time when I first started my postdoc, I didn't have that confidence.
Yeah. So, okay, so then, but if you didn't have that confidence, and no one, and you saw that no one else was really interested in an alternative career.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to start applying for?
Right. So, but because then I start to, you know, working on this develop a GCAMP, right? The genetic encoded calcium indicator. That's basically my project.
Yeah.
I start to really learn different technology, right? Not from molecular biology all the way to systems neuroscience. And I then when I be able to do that, I feel like, oh, I'm capable, you know, I'm capable to learn and to be able to overcome challenges, right? I gain the confidence, you know, why I can give a try. At least I can try.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work out, that's fine. I would just try to find something else. But if I don't even try, how come I know? But at the time, you know, I was really naive when I'm this postdoc. We don't need to apply. Actually, we're not allowed to apply K99. It's an independent grant.
Yeah.
And so then people just think, oh, you come from this Disney World in Genelia. You have no clue about academia, right? Because I had never done any grant writing.
Yeah.
I don't even know what R1 is, the R1, the NIH, system.
Yeah.
So it's quite naive, actually, when I first started my interview process.
I should say, though, when you were feeling like, you know, I don't know if I can do this, and then you had the GCAMP paper, right? This is quite
the
a big paper for you, actually.
Yeah, it's quite a big paper. I think, you know, that time people haven't realized in 2009, I think the field haven't realized, you know, what's this technology gonna lead us to.
Yeah.
But a few years later, you start to say, oh, that's really can transform the system neuroscience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's still your most cited paper.
Yeah, it is my most cited paper. Yeah, for sure.
So so that's, you know, puts you on the radar a little bit for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that you're saying, okay, well, maybe I can give this a try, right? I mean, mm-hmm. That sounds like your father saying, don't give up,
yeah,
don't give up, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so you get the job at UC Davis, assistant professor. But that means crossing the country again.
Actually, back like the same at Juba, I didn't know where is the Davis. I have to Google like Davis.
Yeah.
You know, that's before my first interview. I got invitation to visit school. Yeah. I'm like, okay, UC Davis sounds familiar. Like where it is, and I Googled it. Okay, it's northern. You know, it's between San Francisco and Sacramento.
Yeah.
So I just decided to, you know, to just to check it out. Yeah. And I just really like the community.
Yeah, that's a great school.
And then, it's a great school. I like the sunshine in California because I visited in the springtime, like early springtime.
That's beautiful.
You know, when DC was still cold and had a lot of snow. So I feel like, oh, this is a great place. It's also small enough because at that time I already have my son, my older one is 2 years old.
Uh-huh.
So I have to think about the place I need to. I can strive, but also I can support, have my family.
Yeah,
have a family life. So Davis is small town. It's a great place to raise your family.
Yeah,
and my colleague are very friendly, very supportive. So I just decided, okay, this, I would just take it.
But your husband was working in D.C., so that didn't matter.
He works in D.C., and he decided to support me, so he quit his job.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, and then he eventually found a job in California.
He did.
Yeah.
So what's his career?
He's a chemical engineer.
Yeah.
He also has a PhD in chemical engineer, but now he does. He's a sales manager for South American. So he's in charge 29 countries in South America, and he speaks Spanish.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
He learned it.
He learned it. Yeah, because he have to learn it to be able to do his job.
And what's
he
the
travels
company?
A lot. Chevron.
Chevron. Oh, the oil company.
Oh,
yeah. So you said 29 countries in South America.
In South America.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So he travels a lot. He decided to, again, to support me to move here. And then he took on this new role as a sales manager.
Yeah. So he's still right. So well, he was doing that in California.
No,
what he's doing now.
Yeah,
I see. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're in California. You're settling into this. So I think you're there like 11 years, a 11 long time.
11 years. Yeah. A long time.
Yeah. And so this is kind of where I think, right? You begin, because you'd had the success at Genelia, you begin to look at not only like calcium, but other neurotransmitters, neuromodulators. Mm-hmm. How can we sense these in the brain, right?
Right.
So can you tell me about some of that research?
Yeah. So, you know, when we developed the G-CAMP, right?
Yeah.
I feel like having developing the G-CAMP really helped us to think about, you know, how can we visualize those molecules in the brain? You know, developing G-CAMP, this whole process, you know, we developed the workflow, we learned a lot of knowledge and build the foundations to be able to build a molecule.
Mm-hmm.
That has a sensitivity and specificity to be able to probe the complex calcium dynamics in the brain.
Yeah.
Right? So, but calcium is not only molecule in the brain. The reason we look at calcium dynamics just because calcium is a proxy for
action potentials,
yeah. Right? So not even action potentials, but calcium is great because it's slow, right? You have more photon, so you have better signal-to-noise ratio. But it's not the only thing. And actually, indeed, the calcium dynamics, it's actually the synaptic plasticity, postsynaptic neuronal activity, is modulated by all those input signals. There are neurochemical signals. So I really just want to find out how the neurotransmitter system works across scales from molecule to behavior. But the critical step is to be able to measure them quantitatively.
In
real time. So actually I started to build a glutamate sensor when I was in Lawrence lab. And then I just, from there I'm thinking, okay, I want to look at neuromodulators, like for example, dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember like Alakapoa, she's still a group leader at Gilinia. She came to us, asked, can we make a dopamine sensor? But at that time, you know, I'm like, okay, dopamine, I never thought about. Right, and then I start to look at those literatures. Dopamine is such amazing molecule
yeah.
in everything. So So the hypothesis is, can we build a molecule that actually can transform the dopamine concentration to something like a light signal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so you used GFP for that?
I used GFP for that.
Right. So I had a question about this. Mm-hmm. So as you said, someone came to you and said, well, can we sense for dopamine?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you began to have thoughts, well, why can we sense for everything?
Everyone can sense everything.
Like if we can actually figure all those things out, then you'd really start to figure out how these things work in tandem. Right.
Exactly.
But if you're going to do that concurrently, mm-hmm. you need more than GFP because you have to have different colors show up. Is that right?
Yes. That's what actually we're working on right now, to be able to expand the color spectrum. Not just, you have green, red, but now we want to do the far red, near infrared, and we want to have the color spectrum. Actually, that's what show there.
Oh, on the left.
Right, on the left. To be able to use a color spectrum to be able to differentiate or probe all those molecules simultaneously. Yeah.
So not only do you have to build a sensor, but you have to build whatever that fluorescent mm-hmm. protein is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, and or leverage what's already there and to transform that protein to a sensor, the sensing mechanism. A lot of what we do is we use, for example, today we use AI, AlphaFold, RosettaFold, those simulation to guide the protein engineering. And then we have to use engineering to be able to couple this signal events, for example, the binding, the reporter, the ligand binding domain to bind the ligand. There needs some conformational change during protein binding. And how we transform that conformational change to the chromophore,
uh-huh.
The chromophore changes, for example, protonate state to deprotonate state fast enough to capture millisecond dynamics.
I want to talk about how you got from UCD to here. So it's like 11 years.
11 years.
And you become the vice chair of the Department of Biochemistry and I can't remember.
Molecular Medicine.
That's right, yeah. And then, I don't know, were you looking for a new challenge or what happened? Or did Max Planck come to you?
Yeah, so MPFI came to me in the middle of pandemic. Actually, I gave a Zoom talk. I think the pandemic 2000.
Yeah.
2020, right?
Yeah.
2020. So in the summer of 2020, I gave a Zoom talk to, kind of like seminar. I gave a talk here and I was asked if I'm interested about this place.
Hmm.
And I said, most likely no, it's probably impossible for us to move because I love my community.
Yeah.
It's just,
your kids are being raised there. Yeah.
It's especially Davis is very, very close. Community, we always support each other. And my kids grew up with my colleagues' kids. They play baseball together, right? And we'll talk about science on the baseball field.
that's a nice life.
Yeah. It just feel like, why I want to move. But I also realized, the limitation. I feel like after 11 years at a public university focusing on teaching and also of course research, I start to lose, I want to be fearless again. So, I'm on the search committee whenever for multiple faculty search. Whenever I see the new assistant professor come in, I always tell them, I really miss that time when you start a new lab, you can be fearless. You can dream big.
When you say fearless, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Because I don't think at times your work is fearful, but you're saying fearless like you can conceive of anything. There are no... Because you're just starting out, you can conceive of anything?
And you can conceive anything, right? You can think of... You can dream big.
Hmm.
You have this... You haven't realized, I have to... This NIH, funded research, you have to submit a grant here and there. Of course, I still do that because I like to collaborate. I always writing grants, not a big deal, but I think you just can't, you do feel the limit, right? You have to spend 8 weeks in teaching. I love teaching.
Yeah.
But still, that's take time from you, to think
from
about
your research.
The bigger
right.
pictures. Yep. And then then you do realize, you know, you have to live on the resource you have. But university is big. Your research may not be the focus of the, you know, your research may not be the aligned with the bigger picture of this such a big university. But how can you, and also how can you be able to work, like, for example, like as institute, you can work together because there's always internal funding. You don't have to worry about long-term project, like high risk, because our research is always high risk, high reward. And it's always long-term. It takes longer time to get things to work out and to be able to really, because for me, like, I don't want to just develop a technology. I want to really think about, oh, this is a question we need. This is a question we need to ask. And in order to answer this question, we need this new technology.
Yeah.
But think about to build something from a molecule, from simulation in a in the computational, you know, method. It's a simulation to transform that all the way to a molecule that works in a brain, a living brain, and then you have to really understand, okay, what's the question?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can tackle, what's the killer app? We call killer application.
Yeah.
We can move the field forward, right? It doesn't happen overnight. If you think about sensor development, every single sensor, a major improvement, takes about at least 5 years.
Yeah.
So it's a very long-term investment. Although actually I'm very lucky, I never need to be worried about funding. I'm always well supported by NIH.
Yeah.
But you always think about this, you know, long-term thing. Like, I always have to use the funding, you know, to do something new. And then I will have preliminary data, I can write another grant. But I never be able to do things I don't have to think about. I can just go after.
Yeah.
I really miss the time I was at Gilenia. I feel like that time I can be fearless.
Yeah.
Or when I was a assistant professor, for example, when I started my lab, well, I'm building things, but also applied GCAM to Down syndrome iPSC model.
Uh-huh.
I have no clue how the iPSC cell works. But I'm fearless. I feel like, okay, I will be able to, because I'm naive, I guess, when I was a professor, assistant professor. There's a whole empty lab, what I want to do. And I learned, you know, I have to recruit to get people in the lab. I have to learn how to do the iPSC technology. And then I have to find the collaborators and then eventually find some foundation grant to support me for those bold ideas.
Yeah.
So all my bold idea actually supported first by the foundation grant before the NIH grant. But then when you get to the, at early stage, there's a lot of opportunity to apply early stage, you know, those foundation funding, because you're early stage investigator, they support you.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get to associate professor, or by the time I'm already promoted to professor, the mid-career, there are not many foundation well willing to support mid-career professor anymore, right? So I do have like a CAC foundation, which allowed me to do some near infrared protein engineering work, but that's it.
Yeah, so it's the funding, it's having to find funding that limits the work a little bit, because once you get a grant, you have to sort of stick to what that grant should be
you
after.
You have to stick to it, yeah.
And you felt like here at Max Planck, you would have more freedom.
I have more freedom,
And well, we should say, too, that you did just get a very large grant from the NIH, right?
Yes.
So in October last year, the NIH gave, I think, $11 million for you to work with USC, UCD, Allen Institute,
and Stanford,
right?
Yes.
And basically, it is to come up with new technologies to track neurotransmitters, neuromodulators, mm-hmm. neuropeptides in the mm-hmm. brain, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is, like, if you can do this, it'll open up new areas of research. That's the whole point, right?
That's the whole point. But this grant is about optimization, to optimize technology, right? So we already have the first generation. It's kind of a GCAM evolution. You go, you know, the first GCAM actually developed in 1997, but it cannot be used in the brain, right? So that's why when I was postdoc, we optimized GCAM, make it to meaningful in the brain, and then eventually it got further optimized until today, this past like 15 years optimization. The family, we have the probably the best sensor we can use to have the sensitivity to robustly probe the one single action potential.
So
I can develop technology, but any type of technology can have the first generation, but in order to get optimization, right, it takes time. So this grant is really about optimization. I think what I'm saying is, if you want to try something new that's more risky, usually it's hard to get the funding for those new things. So you know, Max Planck, you know, kind of gave me this kind of opportunity so I can focus on optimization. I still have my NIH grant going. I love the collaboration. But at the same time, I don't have to feel like, oh, I'm only optimizing. I can't develop new things anymore.
Because you've got other funding to do the cutting edge new things.
The risky things, like very risky research. I feel like it's really hard to do very risky things at the, you know, university setting.
Got it.
And also the long term, right? Like your grant can go, can come and go. And so you always have to, especially when your lab gets bigger, I always have to worry about, you know, what if I don't have funding? You know, my senior scientists or soft money positions, they're going to suffer. You know, what I'm going to do, because my nightmare always like, oh, if I lose a grant, you know, what about my people?
Somebody suffers.
Somebody suffer. But I have to ask them to do risky things, because we want to be able to generate new technology. We have to take a risk. Yeah, so that's why I think it's a good time for me to move, because I want to be fearless again.
I love it. Okay, last thing. I have heard you describe the brain more than once. I think this was in a talk you were giving, as I think you said, a dark enclosed box. enclosed space. And that's obviously true, right? I was thinking how, like, you know, we know more about the cosmos than we do about this thing that everybody has sitting above their shoulders, right? We know more about, you know, maybe the bottom of the ocean than we do this thing that sits right here. And of course, neuroscience has made huge strides in the past, like, you know, 40, 50 years. But sometimes it does seem daunting to me, right? You know, if you start thinking about things like cognition, memory, consciousness, you know, why do we dream? All these things that we are still trying to figure out. And I'm wondering if you also sometimes find it daunting, how much there still is to learn.
Yeah, I feel like we just start to scratch the surface, right? We just start to understand in the brain. We still have a long way to go, but that's exciting because it's a, you know, massive unknown space. That I found that's really exciting to go after those exciting ideas.
Yeah,
that's making me, you know, stay up at night. every if you think about biology, right, like molecular biology, cell biology, everything applied to neurons, right? But it's a network, and the brain is so vulnerable, so fragile, but they have like such a high speed, how those things works. So it's a network, you know, it's just amazing. Unknown spaces make me stay up at night.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Fearless. I love that, about how she wants her research to be fearless. Also, Jupiter. I wasn't there very long, but I enjoyed my 24 hours. I saw the beach. It was gorgeous. And suddenly the attraction that people have to that whole area made sense to me. Thank you, Lynn, for spending time with me and for a great talk. When we were done, she took me on a tour through her lab. So thank you for that, too. Okay, this episode will be archived on thetransmitter.org, where we also have a transcript. In the transcript, we have inserted links to the main papers that we discussed. So check that out if you'd like more information. This show can be found wherever you get your podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or in whatever podcast app you use. Some of the information for our intro came from the Encyclopedia of Chicago, from the Illinois Census for 2000, and the website for the Chicago Park District. If you'd like to comment on this show or whatever we do at the Transmitter, you can find us on the social media platforms X, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and LinkedIn. Our theme song was written and performed by Chris Collinwood. Thank you for listening to Synaptic. Until next time. Do you know who that is?
Lin Tianmiao.
Yeah.
I don't know.
She's Chinese. She does like textile art, and now she's doing like installation art.
Oh, interesting. No, I guess I don't Google myself.
No.